Again, Brad Friedman is absolutely one of the best people on this issue and has been for over a decade.
Oh. Thanks, Baron. I appreciate that.
That was nice.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Here I am.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, and in Cottage Grove on KSO. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, Columbus, Ohio's WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Grand Rapids, Michigan's WPRR, New Orleans, WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, in Fayetteville, Arkansas on KPSQ, Seattle, Washington's KODX, Red Bluff and Redding, California's KFOI, Round Mountain, California's KKRN, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950 KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Indie Media Weekly, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, GDPR, Revolution 99, Workforce Rising, and Detour Talk, Blanketing Planet Earth. 5 days a week, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. Joining us being me and Desi Doyen.
Yes, I am here.
We'll see. We'll see. Coming up in a bit, the Department of Interior, led by its wildly corrupt Secretary Ryan Zinke, who I do not understand why he hasn't gotten more attention for his wild corruption. The Department of Interior has been doing Donald Trump's bidding to shrink national monuments created by previous presidents, beginning with Bear's Ears in Utah, designated by Barack Obama, and Grand Staircase Escalante, also in Utah, designated by Bill Clinton. Only monuments designated by recent Democratic presidents.
Funny how that works,
restricted.
Isn't it?
Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
Anyway, in the process of coming up with justifications to shrink these national monuments, which has never been done before by any president, and it's still very unclear whether the administration even has the legal authority to do so at all. In the process of their deliberations, the Interior Department has been reviewing some of the, 27 national monuments. And in the meantime, environmental groups have and media have been pressing Interior to show their work, to release documents regarding the process used to determine it would be okay to shut down these monuments so far, two of them, Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. Well, a couple of weeks ago, the Department of Interior released a bunch of those documents, which they forgot to redact before release. Certain portions of them they wanted to redact, but they didn't. And before they realized their mistake, the documents got out there, and then they asked the media, oh, pretty please do not release the unredacted versions.
Yeah, don't look at that.
Yeah, but
delete it. Don't look at it.
Which
look
is
at
always,
this instead.
Which is always, you know, when you're talking to folks in the media, tell them, don't look at these documents. That's
journalists
certainly,
love
yes.
that.
Well, a comparison between the redacted and the unredacted version turns out to be very telling of these documents as far as what they had hoped, what Interior and Zinke had hoped the country would not hear about, which helps us understand exactly why they do hope to end the public protection of hundreds of thousands of acres of protected lands that contain important archaeological sites and Native American relics and much more. We'll be joined by Aaron Weiss of the Center for Western Priorities shortly to discuss the monumental screw-up by Interior and the wildly corrupt Interior Secretary, Ryan Zinke.
Sounds like fun.
But first, before that fun, very quickly, it was primary election day on Thursday. Yes, Thursday in Tennessee. And I'm happy to report, at least so far, I've heard very few problems concerning voting in the volunteer state on Thursday at the primary, though, as we always warn, it often takes some time until we hear about any such problems or until problems or errors or other failures actually become clear. But for now, good news, it seems like there weren't a bunch of problems on Thursday. So, for now, from the state where most voters are forced to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems on election day, we have some results. If there's any questions about those results, well, too bad because of the voting systems they use. But here's what we know in really the most important key race that people were watching on Thursday. As expected, former Tennessee Democratic Governor Phil Bredesen and Republican U.S. Congresswoman Marsha Blackburn both reportedly won their respective party primaries in Tennessee on Thursday, kicking off what's expected to be a bruising and expensive fight that could determine Democrats' chances of overturning the currently 51-49 Republican Senate majority. Polls suggest a very close contest to replace retiring Republican U.S. Senator Bob Corker this November. A general election win for Republicans would be historic, in that Blackburn would become the first female U.S. Senator ever elected in Tennessee. Democrats, however, are encouraged, even though no Democrat has won any statewide election in Tennessee since 2006, that was when the very popular Bredesen was elected as governor, when he clinched all 95 counties in the state. That was the last time that any Democrat has won statewide, and it was Bredesen then winning the entire state, and Democrats are hopeful that Bredesen will be able to pull off a similar feat in 2018. It has been, by the way, an even longer drought, AP notes, for Tennessee Democrats in the U.S. Senate. The last Democratic victor, Desi, any idea who that might have been?
No.
The last time a Democrat won the U.S. Senate?
No.
In Tennessee? That would be 1990. And that would be a young man by the name of Al Gore in 1990.
Wow.
Last time a Democrat was able to win the U.S. Senate in Tennessee. Nonetheless, Bredesen, who remains very popular apparently, would again need to peel off support from moderate Republicans, if there are such a thing, and independents. Bredesen thanked his supporters on Thursday night, and vowed to be, quote, the best damn senator you ever sent up to Washington. Blackburn, meantime, is a huge and far-right Donald Trump backer in a state that voted for Donald Trump by 26 percentage points back in 2016. She has run in support of Trump's agenda, including building his immigration wall, and for his U.S. Supreme Court pick, Brett Kavanaugh. At her victory celebration on Thursday, she said, quote, we know what Tennesseans say that they want to see in their next senator, and that's somebody who is going to stand with President Trump. She told this to her supporters, and she might be right. Many of her supporters, by the way, were wearing T-shirts emblazoned Marsha, Marsha, Marsha.
Well, at least they have a sense of humor. Yeah,
that's pretty good. Brady Bunch joke for those of you who may not know it. Anyway, Blackburn billed herself as a, quote, hardcore, card-carrying Tennessee conservative from the beginning of this campaign, and she's benefited from center stage appearances with Trump and Vice President Mike Pence in public events and fundraisers in Tennessee. Bredesen, meanwhile, has criticized Trump's tariff policies, which threaten an estimated $1.5 billion in Tennessee exports, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, which is a longtime Republican ally. The exports are linked to more than 850,000 jobs in the state related to farming, steel, baked goods, car manufacturing, whiskey distillers like Jack Daniel's and more, according to, again, according to the very Republican U.S. Chamber of Commerce. So Bredesen has been critical of those tariff policies. Marsh Blackburn is standing by him. She seems to be in favor of him. She has offered some concern about the tariffs, but said that she appreciates the administration's goal of punishing bad actors like China. She has opposed Bob Corker, the outgoing Republican senator. She's opposed his proposal to require a congressional vote on tariffs issued in the name of national security, as Trump has been doing. Which is also a move, by the way, that the other Tennessee senator, Lamar Alexander, supports. So Corker and Alexander support putting some brakes on Donald Trump. Blackburn says, nope, go ahead. You can risk $1.5 billion in Tennessee exports and 850,000 jobs because we got to teach those Chinaman a lesson, I guess.
Well, she is definitely going all in on Trump support.
So she's to the right of Bob Corker and Lamar Alexander and, you know, supports letting Trump continue crippling Tennessee's economy and its workers with these tariffs on China and on the rest of the world, by the way. So just so you know, this is what you'll be voting for out there in Tennessee this November. That, by the way, despite the fact that Tennessee has a history of electing centrists for the Senate, or at least what suffices for centrists from Republicans these days. Heading into July, Blackburn maintained an early 2-to-1 cash advantage over the Democrat Bredesen. But he has if he wins, he would be one of the wealthiest members of Congress, and he's already loaned himself $3.5 million. Mind you, he's loaned his own campaign $3.5 million, and he's still being outspent 2-to-1 by Blackburn. She has $7.3 million in her bank account. Now, there has not been a lot of polling out of the state, but so far, at least, the head-to-head matchups between Bredesen and Blackburn have all found Bredesen up over Blackburn, anywhere from 2 points to 10 points. The Real Clear Politics polling average currently gives the Democrat a 4.5-point lead over the Republican. But we'll see what changes now with those primaries behind us. We'll see if the numbers change. So maybe some good news in Tennessee for Democrats if they can manage to defeat a Republican on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems this fall in Tennessee.
You know, when you put it like that, it sort of reminds people of the stark reality that, unfortunately, when folks are voting on these 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting machines, that there really is no way to know, and now, and it's just going to lead to more questions.
Speaking of 100% unverifiable voting and more questions, I discussed this very key U.S. House special election coming up next week. This is not a primary. This is the actual election coming up next week in Ohio's 12th congressional district, the last big special House election before the November primaries. And how it looks now that the Democrat there could actually flip this long-held Republican House seat from red to blue, even though it's been an historically Republican district centered on Columbus, Ohio, where Donald Trump won this district by about 10 points in 2016. But now it's a very close race. New polling in the 12th district just days ahead of this special election now shows the Democrat and the Republican candidates in a dead heat. After the Republican had been ahead by about 10 points just one month ago. So last night, looks like Donald Trump decided to jump in to help the Republican with a tweeted endorsement before the August 7th special election, and it was a humdinger. Donald Trump said Congressman Steve Stivers of Ohio has done a fantastic job as chairman of the NRCC, that's the National Republican Campaign Committee. He is a great congressman who is tough on crime and borders and an inspiration to our military and vets, big on Second Amendment. Get out and vote for Steve on August 7th. He has my full and total endorsement. It's a powerful endorsement right there from the President of the United States. A lot of buzzwords, a lot of keywords. Encouraging folks to vote for Steve Stivers on August 7th. One problem? Steve Stivers is not running on August 7th. Steve Stivers already won his uncontested primary race back on May 8th when Ohio held their statewide primaries. He's not running in the U.S. House special election on August 7th. It's a totally different guy.
Totally different district.
Bloomberg's Sahil Kapoor noted the error and said President Trump encourages Ohio voters to get out and vote on August 7 for Rep. Steve Stivers, who already won his renomination while running unopposed in the Ohio primary that took place on May 8th. Stivers does, as it happens, leads the National Republican Campaign Committee, so unclear how that error could happen at all. It appears that Trump meant to endorse State Senator Troy Balderson.
Not even close in the name. I don't get it.
I know. He will face off on August 7 in the special election against Democrat Danny O'Connor. The winner will fill the seat vacated by Rep. Pat Tabiri, who left Congress in January. So not even close. In any event, our super stable genius president later deleted that tweet and replaced it with this one that said, looking forward to being in the great state of Ohio on Saturday night, where I will be campaigning hard for a truly talented future Congressman Troy Balderson. See you all then. And he links to tickets to a rally in Delaware, Ohio, this over the weekend on Saturday. So, hey, by the way, if you live in or near Columbus, Ohio, as I discussed in great detail yesterday, particularly to our listeners on Columbus's WGRN 94.1 FM, please make sure to vote next week. Tuesday and this coming Tuesday, August 7, and choose wisely. This seat can be flipped from red to blue, but only if there's a big turnout, which could begin to put the brakes on our ongoing Trump GOP created national emergency. Next Tuesday, by the way, in addition to that U.S. House special election in Ohio's 12th, we'll also have statewide primary elections in Missouri, Michigan, Kansas, and Washington State. So please make sure you are registered to vote and that you turn out to vote on Tuesday. It should be very good practice for this November 6th. And
yes,
give you a chance to find out if you're actually registered as you think you are.
Yeah, that's a good idea to check because Ohio has a very fun purging scheme that they have going on for all of their registered voters that they don't want to vote.
All right, one more story before we get to my guest today. The North American subsidiary of a French chemical manufacturer and two senior staff members were all indicted on Friday in connection with last year's explosion at the Crosby, Texas plant in the chemical plant in the wake of Hurricane Harvey, which we reported closely on the broadcast and the Green News Report. Desi Doyen.
Oh, yes.
This company, Arkema North America, its a CEO and the plant manager were charged in the Harris County, Texas indictment with recklessly releasing chemicals into the air. The charge carries up to $1 million in fines and 5 years imprisonment. That's surprising, Des, in Texas?
I know. It's really, really, really unusual for any corporation to be indicted for any kind of wrongdoing or even negligence. And not just any company in the United States, but especially in Texas.
Especially in Texas, yeah. Even the Harris County District Attorney, Kim Ogg, in her statement, said indictments against corporations are rare. Those who poison our environment will be prosecuted when the evidence justifies it. You'll recall that after the Arkema plant lost power during Hurricane Harvey, its organic peroxides began heating.
Yes, because these are
uncontrollably.
Yeah, these are volatile organic peroxides. They have to be kept below 32 degrees. And of course, when the entire facility was inundated with 6 feet of floodwaters from Hurricane Harvey, mm-hmm. which was ultimately determined to be the largest rainfall event from a single storm on record in the United States.
Right.
That, yes, it inundated all of the equipment there, and the refrigeration equipment went down, and the volatile organic peroxides caught fire and exploded and spewed smoke and fumes all over the 1.5 mile radius. Residents had to be evacuated for more than a week, and I believe 21 people sought treatment at the hospital, including 6 first responders.
Yeah, I was going to say, yeah, the people who showed up to try to help with this, they also got sick.
Yeah.
Spokesman for the company, however, says today that the corporation will fight this indictment. They cite a U.S. Chemical Safety Board report released last May crediting the company for having safeguards that likely would have worked in a low-level flood event.
Yeah, so they had some kind of flood plan, but they had not actually looked at the flood insurance maps that the state of Texas allows for companies to use when determining their flood plans. So they didn't go by the official documents.
And what happened was, as you noted, they ended up getting hit with 6 feet of water, which they say we had no idea. The rainfall was unprecedented. Who could have foreseen so much rain and water, Des?
Except maybe the official Texas flood insurance maps. I don't know.
An internal watchdog, meantime, at the EPA has announced just yesterday that it will audit the EPA and the U.S. Chemical Safety Board. And to look at their response following several high-profile accidents and spills following that historic storm, including those explosions and fire at the Arkema plant. So
yeah.
Maybe a bit of accountability, maybe a bit of good news for a pleasant change. But all right, let's take a quick break, and we will head out west for the fallout from the Interior Department and its corrupt secretary, Ryan Zinke, and his monumental failure on the scam to shut down some of our nation's treasured national monuments. That's straight ahead on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The Bradcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
All right, welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, many of Donald Trump's most corrupt cabinet members have now been forced out of their jobs after months and months of the administration attempting to protect them. The most recent exit, of course, was the wildly corrupt administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, who was and is under more than a dozen official federal investigations at this point. Similarly corrupt, at least it seems to me, but receiving much less attention for reasons I'm not altogether clear about, is Trump's Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke. But new information and a new story and a frankly massive foul-up by the Department of Interior seems like it should help bring more scrutiny to the role that Zinke appears to be playing for commercial industry rather than for the public as the head of Interior. As you'll recall, in April of this year, President Donald Trump signed an executive order instructing Interior Department Secretary Ryan Zinke to review 27 national monuments established over 21 years, arguing that his predecessors had overstepped their authority in placing these large sites off limits to commercial development. Since then, as we have reported here on the broadcast and, of course, in our Green News report, in an unprecedented move for any president, Trump has significantly reduced the size of two of Utah's largest national monuments. That would be Bear's Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante, and has not ruled out altering, limiting, closing down still more public lands, allowing them to be used by commercial drilling, mining, and ranching interests. But in their quest to shrink national monuments, Washington Post's Juliet Alperin was the first to report recently, senior Interior Department officials dismissed evidence that these public sites boosted tourism and spurred important archaeological discoveries, according to documents and that the department released last month, but then retracted and redacted a day later. The thousands of pages of email correspondence before they were retracted and redacted for public release chart how Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke and his aides tailored their survey of protected sites to emphasize the value of logging, ranching, and energy development that would be unlocked if they were not designated as national monuments. The new documents reveal that as Zinke conducted his four-month review, Interior officials rejected material that would justify keeping protections in place and sought out evidence that could buttress the case for unraveling those protections. Many of those points, the points underscoring the need to keep public lands protected, were subsequently redacted for release under Freedom of Information Act requests, but only after the initial unredacted portions were made available accidentally to journalists. As the Salt Lake Tribune's Brian Maffley reports, the unredacted documents from Interior are very revealing, as are the redactions of specific portions of those documents. Maffley explains that Southern Utah's Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument has helped shield archaeological sites from vandalism, bolstered tourism, and spurred scientific discovery during the two decades since its designation, all without displacing cattle operations that have long used these public lands. That's what the Bureau of Land Management wrote in a report released in July. The next day, however, the agency released redacted documents and that downplayed those benefits, and in doing so painted a picture that the monument might not be necessary to protect the resources within its nearly 2-million-acre boundaries. Maffley quotes Aaron Weiss of the Center for Western Priorities, noting that, quote, "You have the secretary being worried if you get rid of the National Monument protections in Grand Staircase Escalante, you will be leaving sacred Native American sites unprotected. And there is no way to replace those protections with the existing patchwork of laws." Weiss notes they were really clear about that, and then they tried to hide that from the American people in the document dump. Critics, of course, contend that the redactions were made because the material undermined Interior's rationale for shrinking monuments and offer proof that the outcome of Zinke's monument review was preordained with an eye toward mineral extraction on land struck from the Grand Staircase and Bear's Ears National Monuments. Acting on Zinke's recommendations last year, Donald Trump reduced the Grand Staircase by about half and Bear's Ears by some 85%, sparking a host of lawsuits from tribal, environmental, and scientific groups. Here to explain all of this, and specifically, pardon the pun, the monumental screw-up by Ryan Zinke's Interior Department, what they were trying to hide and what this may mean for those lawsuits moving forward, not to mention Trump's other threatened closures and reductions of national monuments, is Aaron Weiss. He is the media director, blogger, and podcaster for the Center for Western Priorities, a nonpartisan conservation and advocacy organization promoting responsible policies and practices and working to ensure accountability at all levels to protect public land, water, and communities in the American West. By the way, before joining CWP, Aaron spent 14 years as a journalist and broadcast news producer, escaping that nightmare apparently just in time. And he now also hosts CWP's Go West Young podcast, focused on public lands and the outdoors. Aaron West, welcome to the broadcast, sir.
Brad, thank you very much for having me. It is my pleasure to be here.
Before we talk about some of the specifics in these documents that the Interior Department subsequently at least tried to redact, I know that you guys do a lot of FOIA requests at the Center for Western Priorities, and you watch these document dumps closely. What exactly happened here in, as I called it, this monumental screw-up by Interior?
The short version is that someone just forgot to hit the right button at the end here. You put out FOIA responses using Adobe Acrobat, and stuff that's supposed to get redacted, you use the redaction tool inside Acrobat, and once you're done, you hit the finally redact button, and they forgot to do that here. So what they ended up posting was the full documents, not just unredacted, but you could see both the stuff they were intending to redact and all of the comments they left along the way about why they were redacting them. So it almost would have been even better, you know, for them if they just posted the whole thing without the attempted redactions. But you actually got to see inside the redaction process. So it was a monumental, pardon the pun, screw up.
Yeah, it sure was. The key parts that were redacted from these particular documents, we now know, regards Grand Staircase Escalante, which was designated a national monument by Bill Clinton back in 1996, and detailed, among other things, Native American artifacts that were discovered at Grand Staircase. Since then, they talk about hundreds of cultural sites being inventoried. That was among the material that was redacted. What possible reason would they have for redacting that information?
So the reason they gave, what showed up in the final redacted document once they took it down and reposted it, they called that section deliberative process. So under the Freedom of Information Act, mm-hmm. you're allowed to redact certain things: private information, phone numbers, email addresses, medical information, mm-hmm. obviously. That's all proper. But then you also have this very broad exception. It's called the B5 deliberative process exemption. And it's supposed to be so that officials can discuss policy options candidly, without mm-hmm. worrying about their internal deliberations going out to the public.
Right.
But oftentimes we see that B5 redaction being used as what's called the because I want to redaction.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened here, is because they wanted to redact stuff that just didn't look good for them, they called that stuff deliberative, even though many of these sections were not discussing policy options. They were just basic facts. And that's what you shouldn't be able to delete and call deliberative. Instead, they just crossed out this whole section.
Yeah, you shouldn't be able to. But of course, we wouldn't have even known about that had they released the documents redacted in the first place. We would have presumed that the redactions was that deliberative stuff you're talking about. But in fact, you know, as I say, it notes hundreds of cultural sites have been inventoried, and yet only 7% of the total area of Grand Staircase Escalante has yet to be surveyed. Are these unsurveyed sites the ones that will no longer be protected with the Trump-Zinke shutdown of about half the monument?
Well, yeah, so it's about half the monument. So, you know, huge sections that have not yet been surveyed by archaeologists and paleontologists. And that's one of the ironies here, is that Grand Staircase is very rich in paleontological resources. It's relatively rich in those cultural artifacts and the cultural landscape. But mm-hmm. compared to Bear's Ears, Bear's Ears is a treasure trove of archaeological and cultural artifacts. And we know that inside Bear's Ears, there are tens of thousands of archaeological sites that are in the area that President Obama protected. And again, that whole inventory was still in process. You know, Bear's Ears was only on the books for about a year before President Trump attempted to rescind that and shrink it by an even bigger amount. So when you extrapolate out from what we know that he was being warned at Grand Staircase, we know he must have been getting similar warnings about bear's ears, and it's maybe an order of magnitude bigger in terms of the risk to the Native American archaeological sites there inside bear's ears.
Because we don't know, because this was just a small portion of FOIA requests that they had been releasing, correct? They only screwed up on this one portion concerning Grand Staircase Escalante as far as not redacting what they had meant to redact, correct?
Exactly. They're under a court order to release these documents about the National Monuments Review, and under the court order, they have to release a new batch of documents every month. And they have been doing this for several months now and will continue to do it for the foreseeable future. So if you look at what got mistakenly unredacted in just this one document and think about the tens of thousands of other pages already released and yet to be released, it does raise huge questions about the way they're abusing that B5 deliberative exemption.
Is there any chance, Aaron Weiss, that these this failure to redact, at least for a day, not to be too conspiratorial here, but is there any chance that these were intentionally not redacted? In other words, someone inside of Interior trying to get the message out about this information?
We talked about that and considered it. I personally think it's unlikely because there are only a few, a very small handful of people who have that final say in hitting the redact button and posting. So within the FOIA office, within Interior, they know exactly what went wrong and who screwed it up. And a mistake like this is obviously a very serious offense. I don't know what's going to happen to the person or people who screwed it up. I'd imagine it could be a fireable offense. So if you were someone
unless it was Zinke himself, then it's just fine. He gets to stay. Yeah.
Right. So here's the thing. If you wanted to blow the whistle on this, you could have sent these unredacted documents without fingerprints on them to a House committee. You could have sent them to a reporter and actually kept your fingerprints off it. So the fact that that didn't happen, I think, means this was just a genuine screw up.
Speaking to a few more of the details that we discover here, one of the reasons that many, Republican lawmakers, certainly in Utah, Western ranchers have complained about these federal monument designations of public lands, is that it limits the ability for ranchers to use that land for cattle. But we learn, again, in the redacted portions of these documents, that apparently quite the opposite is actually true, at least in Grand Staircase.
Yeah, that's very true in Grand Staircase, and we've known that. I mean, Grand Staircase has been on the books for 20 years, and the data around grazing, it's measured in AUMs, animal unit months, and the number of AUMs for grazing in Grand Staircase has not changed over the 20 years since Grand Staircase was protected. And that's across all BLM land. The amount of units available any given year go up a little, they go down a little because they are, of course, responding to conditions on the ground and drought and the condition of the land and everything. But you look over the span of those 20 years, there's been effectively no change in grazing at Grand Staircase.
Well, and that sort of guts one of the very big arguments that a lot of the public, the folks who oppose these designations have made over the years. But the redactions also included details on the amount of money that is generated through tourism for commercial business, local economies, and so forth near these monuments. Can you detail some of the benefits to those rural economies from these public lands that apparently Interior Department doesn't want the public to know about?
Absolutely. Because Grand Staircase has been there for 20 years, you've had a recreation economy grow up and develop around that national monument. So you have towns where the economies truly are transforming into recreation-based economies. And keep in mind, Grand Staircase is in the area around Utah's Mighty Five national parks, Zion, Arches. So, and those national parks, of course, are being loved to death. They are overcrowded throughout much of the year. And so you do have this spillover effect because Grand Staircase is equally as spectacular, but not nearly as crowded. So you have this recreation economy in the area that has grown up. And by getting rid of that, the monument protections, you put that recreation economy at risk. We've already seen now an application for a copper mine to reopen in what used to be Grand Staircase Escalante. And then, you also have the risk to the research. Secretary Zinke has on his desk the skull of a Lithronax dinosaur that was recovered inside Grand Staircase Escalante, right around the areas that they're trying to pull out of the monument. So the hypocrisy there for the secretary, he tweeted out a picture of this dinosaur skull. It says right on there, was discovered inside Grand Staircase. That kind of research only happens because of the monument protections.
That research happens, and those artifacts, paleontological or the Native American, those are all lost if we turn all of this to commercial use for drilling and mining, etc., which is what, again, one of those redacted statements in these documents seem to suggest, that without this designation, the other available federal laws will not be sufficient to protect these precious things, like the skull that Zinke displays on his desk. Now, not redacted, Aaron Weiss, from these documents was information on mineral deposits in these monuments, tar sands, coal, etc. Looking at these documents and the subsequent attempted redactions here, what does this tell us? It seems like it tells a pretty clear story about why the Trump administration is doing what they are doing here with these attempted reductions, no?
It does. We'd always suspected that the outcome was preordained, but this really makes it crystal clear that the fix was in from the beginning. And we haven't talked about marine monuments on here, but there are some email exchanges about fishing in the marine national monuments that are even more explicit about getting rid of statements and facts that undercut their case for trying to reopen the marine monuments, both in the Pacific and the Atlantic, to commercial fishing. And there's one amazing exchange where you see them realize that if they lifted the ban on commercial fishing inside Rose Atoll National Monument in the Pacific, it wouldn't make a difference because there's a broader ban on large boat fishing in an area larger than Rose Atoll. And it's like you can hear the sad trombones going off in their heads in this email exchange when they realize what they wanted to do won't actually make a difference because of other protections.
It's kind of amazing, and they're kind of busted, it seems to me, with these documents. I mentioned that these reductions already to Bears Ears and Grand Staircase, that those are being challenged in court. What is the status of those challenges, Aaron, currently? And have the monuments themselves already been restricted as far as which portions of their lands are actually physically protected under the original monument designation, or is everything on hold during the court challenge?
Everything is not necessarily on hold yet. I suspect as this claim for a copper mine inside Grand Staircase moves forward, you will quickly see that attached to the lawsuits. The lawsuits themselves are moving quite slowly. Right now, they're trying to figure out, will the lawsuit, will the trial be held in Utah or D.C.? So we're still at the venue phase of those lawsuits. Once there's a venue, then you're moving into the summary judgment phase. And I was just talking to some of the attorneys about this the other day, and their position is that these documents here that they released don't even come into play yet and probably shouldn't come into play at all, because the issue at hand in summary judgment is, did President Trump even have the authority under the Antiquities Act to shrink a national monument? And there's a very strong case, both in case law, the way the Antiquities Act is written, and then another federal law called FLIPMA, passed in 1976, that make it clear, no, that the Antiquities Act is a one-way act. The president can protect land using the Antiquities Act, but only Congress can undo a national monument designation. Mm-hmm. And so that's going to be the crucial part before you even get into any of this around wasn't made in good faith, anything like that. It's simply a matter of he does not have that the authority. And so that's going to be the first legal issue that gets sorted out.
Yeah, good. I only worry about what protections are lost in the meantime as these long legal fights continue. Aaron, I got just another minute or so here very quickly. I'm not sure why, but as I mentioned at the top, Zinke's pretty obviously corrupt. I mean, pretty obvious corruption in a bunch of areas. And yet, it seems like he has yet to receive the kind of national media scrutiny that one of the other wildly corrupt Trump officials, now former EPA Director Scott Pruitt, received. But as you know, Zinke has been talking about shrinking public lands elsewhere. He's had a very different idea about public lands in his own home state of Montana, near his hometown of Whitefish, where it's believed he plans to run for governor at some point. What can you tell me about why he has not received sort of the same level of scrutiny that that Pruitt had over at EPA as you see it? And do you see that changing now?
I think it is changing right now. I said for months that Scott Pruitt was the best thing Ryan Zinke had going for him because Scott Pruitt was so cartoonishly bad. And Ryan Zinke is right up there. And certainly in terms of investigations, he is up there. We're at a dozen investigations and counting, and I'm pretty confident there are going to be more in the wings. This land deal, this development deal with the chairman of Halliburton in Whitefish to apparently looks like build the secretary a brew pub, which he's always wanted to have. That one's going to have legs.
A brew pub, a brewery.
Yeah, he's had a company called Double Tap Brewing LLC, and he's always wanted to own a brew pub. That's it's a Navy SEAL headshot pun there, along with a beer pun, two in one. So he had a meeting in his office with the developer of this setup in Montana and the chairman of Halliburton, who's one of the investors, and they were together for 4 hours, where they met in his office for 90 minutes. He gave them a behind-the-scenes tour of the Lincoln Memorial, and then they went to a brew pub. And Ryan Zinke insists in that whole time they never actually talked about getting him a brewery that is literally in his emails. We see the email with the site plan for the brew pub directly next to a nonprofit park that the Zinkes have long tried and failed to develop there in Whitefish. So keep your eye on that one. That investigation is going to go places.
And just a coincidence that the chairman of oil services at Halliburton is involved in this brew pub.
Right. Exactly. They claim he was just there as an interested Whitefish resident sitting in the secretary's office. Never mind that every decision Secretary Zinke makes that leads to more oil and gas development on public lands leads to more business for Halliburton because they're the largest oil and gas services company in the world.
Unbelievable. I know you wrote about that at CWP's Westwise blog today. I'll try to point folks over to that story that I hope is a developing story. Aaron Weiss, media director, podcaster for the Center for Western Priorities as well. Your podcast is called Go West Young Podcast, which I love. Great name.
Thank you.
I'll point folks over to that as well. Aaron, really appreciate you joining us to fill us in on all of this and hope you'll stay in touch as the Zinke Nightmare and others move forward.
My pleasure. Happy to come back anytime.
You can find Aaron's work also on the Twitters at A. Weiss. You can find the Center for Western Priorities on the Twitters at WSTRN Priorities and, of course, at westernpriorities.org. Thanks a bunch, Aaron.
Talk to you next time, Brad.
Sounds like he had his child in the background.
Yes,
there.
Yes, I think his little kids had just gotten back from daycare or something. You know, I wanted to add one thing just to pile on about the importance of public lands to rural economies that rely on that tourism. Mm. You know, remember, consider it this way. Local tourism, people that come to visit, that is sustainable revenue that circulates within the local economy and can essentially last forever.
Yeah, it never goes away unless you destroy those lands.
Unless you destroy the thing
that they
want to come look at. And so compare that, contrast that with the extraction industries of mining and logging and drilling. Those destroy the resource. They mine the resource to exhaustion. They leave. They send their profits out of state. Mm. And then they disappear, and that resource is just then gone. And then oftentimes the local folks are also left behind with a toxic site that they are then responsible for paying to clean up.
Well said. Well put, Ms. Doyen, as ever. All right, quick break, and we are back with a few closing thoughts here on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't go away. Hey, this is Brad. If you haven't noticed by now, it's no easy feat finding facts, real facts, not alternative facts, over your public airwaves. We try to bring you real facts, truth, and clarity without fear or favor each and every day on the Bradcast. But we need your help to do it, and that help is needed more now than ever. Please stop by bradblog.com/donate today. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, burns, burns.
Oh, it burns.
The ring of fire.
Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. The Ring of Fire is actually a radio show, a progressive radio show, for those who don't know. That has long been hosted by attorney Mike Papantonio, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., Sam Cedar, and Farron Cousins. It's been years since we've been on, since I've been on that show. Since I've been doing my own daily show, it's a lot harder to do it. But after we got off the air from Thursday's broadcast, I found that Farron Cousins had actually tweeted out a video railing, as we also did on this show on Thursday, against the Republicans in the U.S. Senate who claim to be concerned about the security for this November's elections when it comes to our wildly vulnerable, easily hacked computer voting and tabulation systems, even as they're actually not willing to do anything about it. With the exception of Tennessee's outgoing Senator Bob Corker, all of the Republicans on Wednesday voted against allocating some $250 million in additional money for security upgrades to states before the 2018 midterm. I went on a bit of a rant about that, about the Trump administration's claim that they're concerned about hackers, be they from Russia or anywhere else, and, you know, everyone pretending to be concerned but not really taking any real action to assure the public will be able to oversee their own election results to ensure that they're counted as per voter intent. And the fact that it will be people, the public, who are needed to oversee our elections, which we can't do when they are tabulated by computers, unless we are allowed to hand count, hand marked paper ballots where they exist. So Farron went off on a rant against the Republicans in general for not voting for this money. I'm not sure that this money will actually make a difference, but I'm more concerned about their hypocrisy. In any event, so Farron offered a similar rant on Ring of Fire yesterday in a video that he put out, apparently, and then he was kind enough to include this in his rant.
Here's the bigger problem, though. We have known that electronic voting machines and the voting systems and all of that here in the United States are easily hackable since at least 2004. People like Brad Friedman at the Brad Blog, groups like Black Box Voting, they had been telling us this for more than 14 years. But it was only after 2016 that most of the Democrats, not even all of them at this point, but most of them finally decided, oh, we need to do something about this because it cost us another election. And they want to pin the blame on one foreign entity when it has been proven time and time and time and time and time again by these other people. Again, Brad Friedman is absolutely one of the best people on this issue and has been for over a decade.
He's right. He's right.
It could be done by somebody down the street. It could be somebody in a different room. It could be somebody in a different state. They could be here in the U.S., get into the system because it's so insecure. And Republicans don't even care about that. They do not want to protect our election systems, and the Democrats only in the last 18 months decided that that is important when we have had these very intelligent people tell us for years now that something had to be done because literally anyone who knows how to hack could get into these machines and it could be done as quickly as a matter of minutes to get in there and change vote totals. But again, if we had listened to those other people, the Friedmans, the black box voting folks, Ari Berman, if we would have listened to them years ago, we wouldn't even be having this conversation today.
He's right.
Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire, glad to have him make that rant.
And have him be on the side of good and transparent elections, you know? People need to understand that it isn't just Russia, it isn't just foreign actors, it's also insiders and people next door and people down the street in the United States that could also have this kind of nefarious intent and get access.
I will link to Farron's full video there. You can, of course, follow them at trofire.com. You can watch their videos on the YouTubes at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. Thanks for noticing, Farron. I appreciate that. And thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us today. If you missed any portion of our program today or any of that stuff that Farron was talking about from over the past 14 years, you can get it all for free at bradblog.com. Though my thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate. To help us continue to do what we try to do, what we have been doing for these past 14 years, bradblog.com/donate. You can also drop me email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks and the Twitters, I am simply The Brad Blog. That is it, right?
Well, I do have one more thing I want to say.
Man,
sorry.
What?
Well, just to keep people informed, you won't just find podcasts and radio shows at bradblog.com. You will find a comprehensive database of election integrity articles, election protection, investigative articles on election issues, even broken down by state. So, you know, it's also there for you for that.
Way too many people singing my praise. I got to get out of here. All right, that is it. Thanks, Des. Until we meet again, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire, the ring of fire. I fell into a burning ring of fire. I went down, 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 and the flames went higher. And it burns, 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 the ring of fire.